Hello, welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Kavit Taqwa. UK's Director General of MI5 has warned that Al-Qaeda and its affiliates present the most direct and immediate threats to the UK, where a growing proportion, as he said, of our casework now has some links to Syria, mostly concerning individuals from the UK who have traveled to fight there or aspire to do so. In this debate, we'll discuss how high a risk that is. We'll also discuss the latest in the army advances, Assad's positive cooperation with OPCW and UN inspectors, and the chances for the Geneva 2 conference to actually take place in November.
The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, has hailed Syria for its cooperation on a mission to dismantle the country's chemical weapons.
The cooperation has been quite constructive, and I would say that the Syrian authorities have been cooperative.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has also expressed satisfaction with the progress made so far in destroying Syria's chemical weapons stockpile. A team of experts from the OPCW and UN staff members arrived in Syria on October the 1st for the first mission that calls for the destruction of the country's chemical weapons by 2014. The mission was established under a UN resolution approved last month. The resolution followed an agreement between the U.S. and Russia with the aim of averting U.S. military action on Syria over the chemical weapons use. Washington had accused Damascus of using chemical weapons against its own people during an attack near the Syrian capital in late August. But the Syrian government denies this and has blamed the attack on insurgents it's been fighting since the unrest started there more than 2 years ago. The fighting between insurgents and government forces has continued unabated, with the latest clashes taking place in a town northwest of Syria. The insurgents are funded and armed by countries like the United States, plus some other Western states, as well as their regional allies, Qatar, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. A few days ago, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad told a Turkish TV that Turkey is funneling terrorists from more than 80 states into Syria. The crisis there has already spilled over into some neighboring countries, with signs of the Syria-related unrest seen in Lebanon. Now concerns are mounting that the spillover could go even farther. The head of Britain's intelligence agency, the MI5, is the latest person who has warned about the increased risk of terrorism in Syria. In his first public speech since taking office in April, Andrew Parker said,
"For the future, there is good reason to be concerned about Syria. A growing proportion of our casework now has some link to Syria, mostly concerning individuals from the UK who have travelled to fight there or who aspire to do so."
Officials in other countries like Belgium, France and Germany have echoed the same idea, as reports that extremists had left these countries to join the fighting in Syria. They've expressed concerns that the extremists would one day return to their homelands and be involved in terror attacks. But on the ground, the flow of arms has continued to militants in Syria. French Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian has said that France and Saudi Arabia will continue to provide military and political support to the opposition and the so-called Free Syrian Army. Many observers say the crisis in Syria can't be resolved unless support for militant groups is stopped so that the ongoing fighting is brought to an end. The UN says the conflict there has claimed more than 100,000 lives so far. Millions more have been displaced.
Well, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Debate. Former advisor to U.S. Senate James Jatras joins us from Washington. And we have Middle East expert Jihad Murakadeh, who joins us from Beirut. Gentlemen, welcome. Jihad Murakadeh, how big a threat do individuals from the U.K. who have traveled to fight in Syria pose to U.K.'s national security?
It is an ongoing threat, I would say, because previously those people used to travel to Pakistan and get training from the Taliban and so on, and then come back to the UK. And we know what happened in the UK in 2005, the terrorist attack in London in 2005. And so, yes, they do constitute a threat. Now they are being trained in Syria, trained militarily on the ground by participating in the force, in the combat situation. So I think that the remarks by the head of the MI5, Mr. Parker, is very much in his place.
Let's expand a little bit more on what Andrew Parker has said, James Jatras. He has said that the risk of Islamists in the UK is imminent. Since 2000, we've seen serious attempts at major acts of terrorism in this country, typically once or twice a year. And that feels to me, he said, for the moment, unlikely to change with the threat to have become more diversified. Now, the first question is, do you think this is a direct result of Britain's foreign policy when it comes to their engagements in the wars that they've been involved in, like Afghanistan, like Iraq, and of course, in terms of their backing for these insurgents in Syria?
This is a very good question. I mean,
this is for James Dutras. I'm sorry, Jad Morikata. I have a good one for you coming up after this one, James Dutras, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
I didn't know that was addressed to me. Yes, I think the key word here is blowback. You really do wonder at some point when Western governments will understand that you cannot support moderate terrorists. That if you support moderate terrorists or people you think are moderate, you're going to get blowback of those terrorists back against your own countries. Of course, the granddaddy of all this was Western support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union, which in the context of the Cold War, that seemed like a good idea at the time. That's what gave birth to Al-Qaeda in the first place. We saw the metastasizing of Al-Qaeda through Western support for the jihads in Bosnia and Kosovo. This establishes the organizational links internationally and also provides for the training and transfer of people with experience. Now, in the case of Syria, that's compounded by the fact that we have people from Britain, from the United States, that are traveling to these countries, and as you mentioned in the setup, getting the experience, getting the training, and will someday come home. So yes, of course, this is a substantial risk, and it underlies the wrongheadedness of a Western policy in supporting the insurgents in Syria.
Well, Ajay Morikata, we have Andrew Parker, who has come out with this with these statements. Now, the question comes about here, and I'm speculating, but I'm wondering, because you have countries like the UK, like France, like the United States, who either directly or indirectly are funding these insurgents on the ground. And given the fact that MI5 has intelligence everywhere, why would they not be able to prevent these people from going to Syria in the first place if they're going to go fight there? I mean, in some regards, if we put two and two together, if they're backing the insurgents, then maybe they are looking the other way in a certain respect when it comes to Europeans, in this case from the UK, going there to fight the government of Assad and his forces.
I don't think that when people are going to fight in Syria, whether they come from the UK or France or what have you, they take the plane and they put a badge saying we're going to fight the Syrian regime. So people don't know because they're not flying into Syria. They may be flying into Lebanon and going across or into Turkey or into Jordan. So you don't really know where these people are going. All you know that these people do exist, unfortunately. But from there to say that these countries should not support the opposition and arm the opposition, there is a wide gap here. Because they're not arming the opposition for them to come back and fight in the US and France. They're arming the opposition to face the regime of Bashar al-Assad, who is destroying all his country and all the people. And also, the foreign fighters not represent such a huge amount of people compared to the normal Syrian resistance. The normal Syrian resistance can be Islamist or non-Islamist or secular or across the border, but the foreigners, at the end of the day, they are just a bunch of people. There may be 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 out of 100,000.
Okay, the 100,000 that you're claiming there, Jihad Morikata, based on the research that we've done, is not that amount anymore. It did peak at that amount, but it is far less. But the number of these people from Europe, James Jatras, please elaborate more on this if you have any information. Of course, I'm going by from hundreds to 1,000 when it comes to from the UK. We have in the hundreds with countries like the United States, even Germany, Belgium and France to be involved. I mean, I'm trying to put together a picture here of how big a threat these individuals cumulatively may oppose when they come back to their home country.
I think they're a substantial threat, even if it's only a few individuals, a few dozen, maybe a few hundred from each of these countries. But let's not forget the large numbers of foreign fighters that are also coming from countries like Saudi Arabia, where there have been reports, for example, of being offered release from jail if they go to fight the good fight in Syria. So as the foreign fighters become a very substantial element of the anti-Assad forces in Syria, and as these even relatively small numbers of individuals from the UK, the United States, France, and so forth become integrated with these foreign fighters from elsewhere that are coming to Syria, plus the more radical elements in Syria, I think they become a very substantial threat to our country, even if they are not that large of a proportion of the entire group. Let's remember that the most recent terrorist attack in the United States, the Tsarnaev brothers in Boston, they were just a couple of people, a couple of boys from Chechnya, whom were looked at by many people here as freedom fighters because they're fighting the bad, bad Russians. I think we'll see the same kind of attitude about some of these fighters when they come back that, oh, well, these are good boys. They were just fighting the bad Mr. Al-Assad. I think it's a very mistaken perspective.
Well, let's take a quick time out, listen to some of the viewer comments as posted on our Facebook page on the topic. Let's take a listen to them now.
Create a problem so they can justify fixing it through militarizing the police force and increasing domestic surveillance. Then stop arming them. Stop supporting them. They killed and beheaded innocent Syrian people, innocent Syrian children. You reap what you sow.
Okay, those were just some of the comments there. I'd like to get your impression, Jihad Markade, at the one of the key things here. And you said there was a gap in one of the statements that I made in terms of these people that amount to not many of these people coming from European countries as an example. But nothing is going to work, would it, Jihad Markade, if the countries like France, like the UK, are still funding and either directly or indirectly arming these militants, whether you have the Geneva II conference coming up or anything else that is going towards a political a solution of any kind. Why do these countries continue to do this? Is it because they want to gain grounds before the Geneva II against the army of Assad so they have some bargaining power perhaps at the table?
Give me some time to answer this question. First of all, we know very well that Russia is arming the Syrian government. Second, we know very well that the opposition started very peacefully for about 6 months while the Syrian army was shooting at it. So from this perspective, yes, they need to be armed to be able to face a much better armed Assad regime. Now, with regards to Geneva II, it is really the Hezbollah in Lebanon which really made the difference, because the Syrian regime was losing ground for quite some time until Hezbollah intervened on its side and was able to help him regain the town of Qusair. And this is when the opposition started to lose ground. Now, when the opposition started to lose ground, there was a serious case of the need to arm the opposition. Now, France, the UK, and the US back in April said that they wanted to arm the opposition, but they didn't do anything about it. And they've been arming them so slowly that these people are being slaughtered by the Assad regime and nobody cares about them. And one of the opposition leaders said, by the time the West really makes up his mind and sends us some serious weapons to fight those tanks and those planes, there will be nobody left to use those weapons. Arming them with light arms is nothing. You are facing tanks, you are facing aircrafts, you are facing helicopters. Well, so yes, with regards to Geneva II, there is no way there's going to be a Geneva II unless the opposition regains some ground.
Okay, let's expand more. And I've gone through this question a number of times in the past, but James Jatras, you know, we're looking now at a pivotal point, I would think, regarding these groups that are on the ground, because you're having, as an example, it was almost 2 weeks ago where 13 of these insurgent groups, including some powerful al-Qaeda-linked factions, that basically slammed the Turkey-based Syrian National Coalition. That's also backed somewhat by its president, which is Saudi-linked, that they no longer represent the interests of the Free Syrian Army and therefore the opposition. I mean, at this point, you have these different factions vis-a-vis some infighting, and then, of course, putting into question the actual representation that the SNC has, along with the FSA. So, clarify the picture for us as to what's going on in these two camps, the Syrian opposition, that's Western-backed, along with the different groups that are on the ground.
I think there's very little question that it is increasingly likely that the Assad government is going to win this war. That is something that the Western powers may not want to admit, that they are still perhaps through inertia supporting the opposition to an end that they're not sure what the outcome will be. But I think it's clear with the U.S. and Russian cooperation on the removal of the chemical weapons, the fact that there have been reports that some Hezbollah fighters have been sent home to Lebanon because they're not needed anymore, that the government has achieved the upper hand. I don't see that negotiating an end to this war is predicated on sending more weapons to the opposition, which will continue to be dominated by the al-Nusra Front, by al-Qaeda-linked groups, and the hope of a democratic, secular, open society deriving from that camp is almost impossible to imagine. The best outcome, it seems to me, and you're beginning even to see this in the American media now, that maybe an Assad victory is not the worst outcome than we could imagine. So let's think of some way to turn the chemical weapons procedure into a segue, into a negotiated solution. At some point, it might be appropriate for the countries that are supporting the Assad government also to restrict some of the weaponry, but I don't see what pouring more weapons into the hands of the rebels is going to accomplish except more suffering and more killing and more destabilization of the region.
And of course, the big question comes, Jihad Amarkade. Are these radical groups? They've called for a clear Islamic framework based on Sharia law to be the real source of legislation. I mean, they're obviously this is a reference to al-Qaeda's factions' aspirations to create an Islamic state. Let's even hypothetically speaking, say that this Geneva II is going to have some kind of solution. What are they going to do with these groups? Such as the one I mentioned, or ones that are conformed under this Sharia law that they want to have exercised there. What are they going to do with these groups once that political solution comes about?
It depends, first of all, which political solution you're talking about. If you are talking about the Geneva II conference as determined in Geneva on 30 June 2012, between the Russians and the Americans, which is a handover of power, of all executive power by the president and the actual government to a new government, a new coalition government, then the new coalition government, of course, is going to face down these fighters and with the use of the army, but this time it will have the support of the whole world against these small groups. Now, if there is no solution or a Geneva II conference, in this case, there is no way in the world that these individual groups would be able to establish an Islamic State in Syria. They'll be able to establish an Islamic State in pockets of areas that they control, a little bit like the Mujahideen do or the people in Mali, Al-Qaeda in Mali did. But that's all in the areas that they control, but that would not be able to control the whole of Syria and the government and so on, because most of Syria is secular.
Okay,
I don't see them at all being able to control all of Syria.
Well, let's get an idea from James Jatras. The idea of Geneva II at this point seems to have a date, James Jatras. You're aware of it in mid-November. We have the SNC that has already come out and said that the deal with the transition government they agreed to, but they don't want to sat there basically still setting a precondition. Are they in a position to even do that? But as we've seen the weakening of the SNC and along with the FSA, are they really ready at this point, which appears to be on the horizon, that there might be a negotiated solution? What are your thoughts on the chances of that happening?
I think it's very hard to tell. I think there are a couple of hurdles to it. The first one is the extent to which two men, President Barack Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry, are committed to this, or whether they're still looking for some backdoor way to have Bashar al-Assad's departure as a precondition for any kind of discussion. It seems to me that's a very mistaken policy guideline to set down that is not conducive to U.S. interests. The other one is that if anything coherent and serious can be brought to bear from the opposition side that could actually be a partner for the government in a discussion about peace. If there's any kind of responsible spokesman voices that can actually negotiate. On the question of whether most Syrians are actually secular or not, maybe they are, but it seems to me the majority of the secularists are going to be supporting the government. Is there a critical mass of secularists on the rebel side who can be responsible partners for a discussion for some kind of power sharing arrangement and concessions to the opposition that excludes the more radical elements, which generally, I think, will have the upper hand if this war keeps going on?
Thank you very much for that. We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. Former advisor to U.S. Senator James Jatras talking to us from Washington, and Middle East expert Jihad Murakata talked to us from Beirut. Thank you for watching another edition of The Debate. Any questions or comments, newsroom@presstv.ir is our email address. From Mikhail Tafwai and the entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.